Bob Kaufman.
Cheryl Jernigan. Hello? Hello? Hello?
Hi, it's Gina Schott.
Oh, hi, Gina. This is Jeff. Hi, I'm glad you could join us.
Hi, Jeff.
It's Cheryl.
Hey, Carol. Good afternoon. This is Rob. Hey, Rob, we have a few folks here. Great. Great. Why don't we get started? It's 3:30 or a minute past. Thanks, everyone, for joining. What we normally do is just I talk for 15, 20 minutes or so until everyone gets sleepy, and then we open it up to questions. And so you can email them or just wait until I ask for questions, whichever is more appropriate for your style of communication. So it's a lovely dry winter here in Santa Fe. We had a little bit of precipitation and hope springs eternal. I'm not sure we're going to get much moisture before springtime, and so we spend a lot of time looking at the financial markets so that we're not too worried about the moisture levels here in New Mexico. I think that everyone has been pleasantly surprised by the beginning of the year, the certainly in the U.S., the stock market going up 5% in January following all of the anxiety surrounding the close of Congress in 2012, which turned out to be what I thought was a reasonable short-term compromise on the tax situation with absolutely no resolution on the spending side. I think that is coming up in the next couple of weeks in terms of automatic sequestering. And a lot of things that I look at indicate that Congress will not be able to reach any kind of agreement. But happily for us, the markets are most likely to just shrug off and ignore the political process. Not that the budget deficit isn't important or that long-term issues don't need to be dealt with, but the great majority of stock investors and bond investors are under the impression, because of the extremely strong support over the past 3 or 4 years, of a continued flow of government central bank money into the markets. And this is the primary cause for the increase in the stock markets around the world. It always amazes me when a politician or a central banker can say something about a policy and that the markets react as if that really had an effect in the real world, in the real economy, for people trying to make a living, for businesses looking for capital, for people trying to sell houses or buy houses or whatever. But happily or unhappily, that's the environment that we live in. And so we have a kind of a complacency globally with the European Central Bank, the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, the Japanese government bank, all very much promoting what we call easy money or high liquidity kind of situations, where any blip in confidence, any downturn in the economy, or really strongly ruffled feathers are soothed over by the promise that the central banks will continue to provide mechanisms by which banks are essentially held able to be given money risk-free. They can turn around and invest it in government bonds at what may be a low interest rate, but certainly there's a positive spread. So the banks have essentially been insured to some level of profitability so as to not lose the public's confidence. And this has gone on, and happily so, for the markets. It's been some great years. We're now back to the level at which the markets were before the financial meltdown in 2007. And I remember when we were in our office and then word came down that some hedge fund, I can't remember the name of it, was going to take Chrysler private, and they were unable to sell their bonds. And that was the first inkling of financial trouble. All of that is in many ways still the situation, that what we are looking for in terms of signs of any kind of a loss of confidence in this current central bank driven rally, kind of another asset bubble, you may say, just like we had a bubble in asset values in the technology markets in the 1990s and in the real estate market in the 2000s. What we are seeing now is kind of an asset bubble in bond market prices, which has started to spill over to stocks, I think, though many people believe stocks still have a ways to go up before they need to correct. But the one indisputable fact is that it's not real world economic activity that's driving the markets up. It is the flood, the preponderance of money, which is looking for some kind of return. And many of our clients who are essentially conservative in nature are understandably disappointed in the ultra-low interest rates and earnings on what were traditionally fairly low-risk investments like bonds. And so they are forced, as are people around the world, to look for risk assets, assets like stocks, whether they're dividend-paying or not, or real estate investments. But in any event, the 30-year old bull market in bonds is pretty much, well, it may not be at an end. There are many people who think that the U.S. Treasury, the 30-year Treasury, could go down to 2%, which would be another big leg up in the price of bonds, which have appreciated actually more than stocks this last decade. And kind of a very unusual situation where stock portfolios that we're putting together are paying almost twice the dividends that bonds are paying interest now. So it's very unusual. No one can quite imagine how this situation will come to end, where we'll move into a new phase of the markets. It's likely, as I've said many times before, that we'll wake up one morning and interest rates will have moved up. It doesn't take much for bond investors to get skittish and start selling bonds. And so it's that's certainly the thing to watch out for, are rising interest rates. And even some of the people inside of the central banks know that this kind of paper money that's been created has very serious long-term potential downsides in terms of devaluing currencies, in terms of reducing people's confidence in long-term investments in businesses, investing in plant and equipment, so that that jobs are created. I'm just going to pause here for a second and ask if people are moving around or on cell phones, if you could put it on mute so that the static level goes down for the rest of us. Thanks very much. What are the other things that are going on in the markets that are important to us and of interest? I think there is now, over the last 2 months, we've seen Japan, the politics in Japan, change a great deal. There's a new prime minister. His last name is spelled A-B-E, so I call him Honest Abe. And Honest Abe has committed Japan to devaluing their currency to a depreciating a currency so that their export industries are stimulated and that their economy has some stimulation. This is kind of the opening public salvo in what may turn into be a worldwide movement towards competitive devaluation, also known as currency wars. This is potentially a very dangerous thing. It's what happened during the Great Depression when all the countries were kind of lackluster in terms of growth. And one easy way to stimulate growth is to try and devalue your nation's currency. Makes it much more difficult for consumers in the host nation to buy imports. That helps local businesses because they sell more. It also helps manufacturing and export-driven companies to sell more because effectively their goods are cheaper to foreign buyers. So it's actually a form of inflation, having a devaluing currency. Japan has been in a long period of deflation, and we'll come back to that later. South Korea, Taiwan, China, lots of countries are very resentful of Japan's recent moves. Interesting to note that Japan's stock market has gone up about 32% since mid-November of last year in response to this new political, sort of politically driven fiscal and monetary policy. And we'll see this year if other nations in retaliation try and do the same thing with their currency. If too many nations try and do it at the same time, then it's essentially a trade war with money. And what happens is that all economies shrink. When everyone tries to get a bigger piece of the pie gets smaller. That's the net result. So we'll see if that happens. Another result of this central bank funded rally is the renewed interest on the part of many governments to increase their gold reserves. Recently, Venezuela demanded return of their gold reserves from the United States, and after a little bit of hoopla, that was done. Apparently, Germany is calling its gold bullion home from New York as well. They're thinking they'd like to keep about 50% of their nation's gold reserves on German soil, in German vaults. And very curious, because we haven't seen this in a long time. It's almost as if this kind of floodgate of money where it's just being printed has made countries wary of what might happen to their currency if there were continuous currency devaluations, or let's say a run on a nation's currency, or there was some kind of event that every country had to go it on its own as opposed to relying on international trade. And so gold has traditionally been the backing of most currencies up until 1971. And what we perceive is that many countries, especially China and natural resource-rich nations, are looking to diversify and change the sort of standard way of business of trading in U.S. dollars. And they're looking to replace that with a basket of commodity or natural resource-based items on which no one can inflate or print their way just for any domestic or political advantage. And so China is also raising their gold reserves, and China is also starting to do trade in oil and other commodity-based currencies without using the U.S. dollar. So that's troublesome because we have essentially had, I won't say a free ride, but a much easier time of it the last 10 or 20 years in terms of increasing our deficits without having outside scrutiny like you see in Greece or in Italy or Portugal, Spain, Iceland, Ireland. Soon France will undergo that kind of scrutiny. But the United States has essentially been seen as a safe haven and as the world's sort of trade currency. We've been funded. Our deficits spending are the low cost of borrowing in the United States has been subsidized really by foreign investors. And if that were to change in a hurry, it would have a really very drastic effects on the markets. So let's see, the real economy, unemployment is sort of stagnant around, I'd say, 8%. It depends on who you believe and how many people have stopped looking for work, whether people who are college-educated who are working part-time in restaurants or coffee shops because that's all they can find. They're not considered unemployed, but they're certainly underemployed. And the question of always is how do real jobs get created? Is it by small businesses or large companies? I don't think there's any doubt that most job creation over the last 5 years has happened in companies with fewer than 50 employees, and that corporations, large corporations, are continuously downsizing in order to achieve higher levels of profitability for their shareholders to show so that the stock prices stay up. And it's very difficult to know what will create the number of new jobs that are necessary, not to say that there aren't many jobs going wanting in the technology sector. People who have technical skills are still greatly in demand, and that's become a very... important part. Am I still on the phone, or did I get cut off? Oh, okay, good.
There.
Great, thanks. I heard some beeping and tweaking and et cetera, so good. So the issue of where employment, you know, in the real economy, how that will get generated over time is really a mystery. at our regular discussion yesterday here in the office, we talked a little bit about starting new businesses in the U.S. and the we're definitely perceived and the sort of evaluations of the ease or difficulty of starting new businesses is gauged by people across borders, and the U.S. is considered one of the more difficult places to start new businesses because of regulations and things like that, the amount of paperwork. People are still doing that and always will, but other countries have a higher rate of new business startups, both technology and other retailers and things like that. I am kind of a big believer that there are young people, many young people coming out of college interested in local businesses, particularly in agriculture, but I may well be biased by my youngest daughter's preference for those kinds of activities, since she's working on an organic vineyard in Northern California and seems to be headed in that direction. So I'm grateful for that. Let's see. Before I open it up to questions here, I'll talk a little bit about the bond market and diversification, the kinds of things that we're doing now. I think it's clear that, from at least our view, is that the biggest risk to the market is rising interest rates, and so we are remaining very short term in the bond market. I believe there's a case to be made for shorting the long bond, the 30-year bond, especially high-yield bonds, which have had essentially a 10-year run as they never have seen before. That is, low-quality companies issue bonds, and they yield more. They have a higher interest rate than government or high quality corporate bonds, because so many people are looking for interest and income from their portfolio and desperate to get higher rates than certainly CDs or the very low high quality rate of 2-3% today. Those lower quality bonds have done very well because there's so much demand for them. I believe that situation will reverse as interest rates go up, and so that's a different kind of a play on the bond market. The price of gold has been relatively stable for the last 2 years, as has silver. One would think if there was a loss of confidence in currencies, in government paper, that that the price of gold would go up, and it really hasn't. And that's kind of an open question as to why it hasn't. I don't know, but that's when we buy gold, we look at really the long-term insurance aspect that gold provides to portfolios, because if there were to be a loss of confidence in paper assets, then gold and other agricultural commodities and energy in particular would probably gain with investors moving to those more kind of hard or reality-based assets as opposed to financial assets. So let's see. I think I've gone on for about 25 minutes. I'll open it up to questions and see if anyone on the phone has any questions.
I don't have a question, Rob. This is Molly, but I'm supposed to announce myself.
Okay.
I'm Molly.
Great.
Hi.
One question is that since the legislators basically deferred things till March, what do you anticipate will happen then?
Well, I don't think that they will reach an agreement about any long-term revision to the U.S. entitlement programs, or that the tax code will be reformed. So I think that the automatic spending cuts will take place, and defense will have to cut as well as domestic programs. So I don't think that's a disaster for the markets in any sense. It may be the best thing. I think the whole kind of scare tactic that it would be a disaster if we had the automatic spending cuts take place is just kind of overblown. I don't perceive there's a, I don't really understand politics that well, but it seems to me that no one can really be blamed if the automatic spending cuts take place, and that's probably the default position there. But again, the Federal Reserve stands ready to continue to buy, let's say, $80 billion of bonds every quarter. And in case anyone's not familiar with that technique, it's when you are out of money and you need more money to pay your interest on your old loans, if you have a printing press and you're allowed to print money and then lend it to your own bank so that they can buy government bonds, it's a self-fulfilling cycle. And so no one really needs to report anything negative in that scenario. So I think that's likely to happen. One question that was asked yesterday in response to that was about gold. Is gold at a decent price now? And my answer was that whether gold is at $1,600 or $1,400 or $2,000 an ounce, it represents, as I said before, it represents something that if there's a loss of confidence in paper money, then gold will increase. Now, some people think that gold only goes up with inflation, and that's not really true. We had a lot of appreciation in the price of gold, even in the deflationary years since the financial meltdown. It's essentially considered to be one of the best safe havens, and I think it will continue to provide that. So putting 5% or 10% of a portfolio into different forms of gold is not a bad idea. Most people own gold in the form of a stock that represents the price of gold. It's essentially a promise by a bank that somewhere they will buy gold and that they will redeem these stock shares relative to how the price of gold is changing. And that's quite different than owning or holding the actual currency. So when we buy gold, we recommend that people do it through various formats and not just buying the easy stock that represents gold.
Okay, thanks.
Good.
Other than gold, where should people be putting their money right now?
You know, a lot of people are looking at real estate as a possible diversification, and someone asked about renewable energy as well, or infrastructure companies. So maybe we'll cover all three of those possible areas of investing money. Real estate in many markets has changed dramatically over the last year because interest rates are so low, and the banks now, if you're a qualified buyer, a commercial buyer, they very much want to lend money, and so the price of real estate, of good commercial real estate, has gone up in many urban markets in the U.S. So one diversification as a way of hedging against inflation or the devaluation of a currency was and still is to look for income-producing property. Now, most people who've done that themselves know what a big hassle it is. The way that we were doing it and still are, we're buying buildings that had high-grade tenants like the post office or, I guess, Walgreens. Maybe some people don't think the post office is too high-grade, but I do. And so we were earning, you know, anywhere from 6 to 10% on these triple net leases. But now there's so much money that's been created, as I mentioned before, that's looking for an alternative to bonds, that the price of most of the real estate that we bought over the last 2 years are up about 30%, which is great if you're looking to sell them, which we're not, but it's terrible if we're looking to buy more, which we are. And so that avenue has very much been curtailed given the continuous sort of flooding of the market with money. Now, renewable energy or utilities is another area, just kind of basic essential services is the area that we focus on when we buy bonds. And sometimes we'll look as far afield as Puerto Rico, which is on a credit downgrade watch, meaning that Puerto Rico does not have its fiscal house in order. But it is difficult to imagine that there are many school districts, many municipalities that are going to let their schools close because of budget considerations. They're much more likely to reduce other services, to, you know, cut down on extracurricular things if there are any left. But there are, and particularly in California, a lot of school districts that issue bonds, and we like those. The renewable energy area is something that it does not generally pay a dividend, and many people feel intuitively like, well, you know, the environmental situation is getting worse. President Obama has committed to supporting renewable energy. I saw, and actually thank you, Molly, for sending that thing over about the divestment from oil movement that's going around some municipalities and college campuses. The problem with renewable energy is that it takes, generally speaking, government subsidies to get up and going, and doesn't really make much of a profit, certainly not for the first, couple of years or even a decade. And so while many people would like to support moving away from carbon-based fuels, it's very, very difficult to make money doing that kind of thing. Now, making money, there are some utilities that we buy is specifically in natural gas that have very high cash flows. And some people think natural gas is clean. Other people, you know, don't like the way it's starting to be recovered with the fracking techniques. Someone told me on the yesterday that the satellite images now show the big cities as the bright lights, plus North Dakota, where Jeff is from, is essentially on fire most of the time from the gas wells. and that that's now showing up on the satellite images, which surprised me, but I don't doubt it. But natural gas, liquefied natural gas, the U.S. has seen a marked change in its energy prospects over the last year. We have become a net energy exporter. We no longer need like a standing army to ensure the supply of oil from the Mideast, though, of course, it's already in place, so it's not going away. But the U.S. is seen to be becoming one of the world's great energy exporters in the form of liquefied natural gas and coal, and owning some of that infrastructure that is high dividend paying is a part of our strategy for many people.
Okay.
Let's see, there was one or two other questions, and are there any other questions from people on the line? All right, well then I'll just continue and probably go another five minutes or so and talk a little bit about inflation versus deflation and what the appropriate portfolio response might be to those different scenarios. The fact is that we have conflicting reports about inflation, and some goods and materials are going up in price, like organic food or airplane tickets. Certainly Southwest fares have gone up, as far as I can tell, while the cost of electronic goods, mass-produced things that can be made in Asia and shipped, have come down. The price of professional services has gone up. I know that I pay easily twice as much to a dental hygienist now as I did 5 years ago. But at the same time, the wages for most non-executive people has gone down. So we have deflation going on in wages, in houses in certain parts of the country, in electronic goods, but we see the prices going up for certain kinds of goods and services at the same time. So there's not really anything categorically true about inflation or deflation. The places like Japan would like to see more inflation. That's why they're printing money and devaluing their currency, because they feel like people will start to spend money rather than keep it under their mattress. That's what people do when there's a lot of inflation. Like traditionally Brazil was a high inflation country, so people spent their money, whether it was on costumes or airplanes or whatever. It generated a lot of economic activity. While people who were living on fixed incomes, let's say pensions, were hurt by inflation. For the last 20 years in Japan, prices have been going down for most things, and people who retired on fixed incomes were doing quite well, because they could buy more every time they got a retirement check because prices were going down. The problem with deflation is that it basically promotes a constricting economy. People don't want to spend because they want to wait until their money can buy more. Their earnings power is going down, and there's not a lot of confidence in the future. In an inflationary environment, people want to spend money, they want to borrow money and then spend it, because they get to pay it back their loans with cheaper dollars. In an inflationary environment, prices are rising for most things, and it's a little crazy-making, but most people certainly over 40, remember the inflation, and the inflationary expectations are still in most people's minds. My sense is that we'll have a combination of the two, that wages will not go up for a very long time, and that the costs for good medical care, for high-quality travel or food will go up at the same time as the earnings power goes down. So not really a very clear answer about inflation versus deflation. The portfolio strategy for contending with those circumstances are quite different. In a deflationary environment, one wants to own bonds because bond prices go up as inflation goes down. In an inflationary environment, one wants to own real assets that are inflating in terms of their prices, so one would move away from bonds and into stocks, which seems to be happening now. The public seems to be moving cash out of bond funds to stocks because stocks have had several years of growth. I'm not sure that's especially wise for people with limited resources, but that's the way that it is. And we certainly have purchased stocks, internationally diversified companies that pay good dividends, still our focus. U.S. large companies, the S&P 500, the high dividend paying ones, are very positive for us, as are the gas pipelines, as I mentioned before, and there are different ways of buying those. So I think that pretty much sums up what I had to say for today, and if there are not any more questions, we'll sign off.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for joining. Good. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.